Week 5. I'm out of commercials, so we'll see what we can dig up for Friday. A couple of announcements. So we'll be returning your quizzes at the end of class today, likely out in the hallway or outside there. So the teaching fellows will make some announcements when the time comes. Super section today, focusing particularly on GDB and usage thereof, led by Paul Govereau, one of our teaching fellows, Science Center E, 6 p.m. It will be filmed if you can't make it. Finally, Roy will be leading a hacker section today, 7 p.m. in the Maxwell Dworkin Cafe. Any questions before we begin? All right, so we began what is, for some folks, a bit of a scary topic on Monday, that of pointers. So in an English sentence, just what is a pointer? Excellent. So it's a variable that rather than containing a value per se, instead contains the address of a value. So let's see if we can't make this clear with a bit of a sample here. So sample.c. I'm going to whip up a really quick program here. I'll go ahead and include standard.io.h so that I can print something out. I'll declare main. It's going to take its two parameters, argc, char star, argv. And then let's see, give me an int x, let's say, and then let's give me an int, what if I want to declare a pointer called p to an integer? What's the syntax here exactly? Yeah, so just add a star, that's all it means. So that's going to be a pointer to an int of some sort. And now let's go ahead and do this. So x is going to be the value 5, let's say. And now meanwhile, let's go ahead and say printf, %d, new line. And I'm going to go ahead and print out the simplest possible program here, sample.c, by running make sample, unused variable p, and that makes sense because I haven't actually done anything with it yet. But if I go ahead and run this, obviously, what are we going to see? 5. Wow. Terribly fascinating. Well, now let's take it up a notch. So if I instead want to demonstrate exactly what's going on with respect to pointers, take a look at this. Rather than print out x, what is the implication if I instead print out ampersand x? Yeah, so this is the address of operator. So in theory, what I should still see is an integer, as implied by this %d, but this integer is hopefully going to represent a... That's okay, that warning. What this integer is hopefully going to represent is the address of x in memory. Now, that's kind of a big, ugly number. What's going on here? Well, that's an address. Let's make this clear. Let's cast it to an int so that printf doesn't complain. And in fact, just to be consistent with last week or with Monday, let's use %x, which take a guess what that denotes. Still a number. Hexadecimal. So we'll let the program figure out what it's supposed to look like in hexadecimal. If I run this thing now, what we have is that sequence of hexadecimal digits that looks reminiscent of some of the stuff we saw while poking around with GDB, which is to say that I had no real control over where in memory X ended up. Recall the rectangle that we've been talking about as representing a program in memory. I really have very little control as to where things end up in this memory space for the most part, but I can at least with C, using this kind of syntax, at least poke around and figure out where things are, in fact. Well, now let's come back to pointer p. If I want to store in p the address of x, what do I need to type here? Sorry? So star p equals ampersand x, almost, but not quite. So no star. So remember that p itself is a pointer, so it's already destined to receive the address of something. So if we just say p gets ampersand x, that's going to put the address of x in p. So now let's go ahead and do this. I'm going to print out not ampersand p, but just p, because again, p here represents an address already. I'm going to rebuild this program. I'm going to run sample. And now I see, well, that's a little strange. It's a different number, but should that be worrisome? Yes? No? Yeah, I mean, we ran the program again, and this is just to emphasize when you're running your programs, you can't trust where things are going to end up physically in memory. Sometimes things are indeed going to get moved around, but the point, though, is still the same. Now we've seen the address of P, or the address of X, rather, as it's stored in P, but now let's take this full circle. Now, just for the sake of discussion, suppose that I want to print out not the address of X, or that is equivalently P, but instead, I want to print out the value x. Well, the obvious fix here, I'm going to go back to %d so we actually see the number 5. I can certainly just do this. right, and actually print out x. Right? That was where we began this story. But if I instead want to make use of p somehow, how do I tell the program to not print p, but print the value stored at the location referenced in p? Yeah, so star p. So again, we're sort of using this star notation in different contexts for different reasons, but that's really all there is for new content. And now we get back the value 5. So a trivial little exercise, and this program itself certainly does not make clear why you would ever care to do this. So let's actually now see in context why these kinds of tricks might be more useful. So we've talked for a while about arrays, and you're using arrays in the game of 15 to represent what? Even though you didn't have to write this bit of code yourself. Yeah, so the two-dimensional game board itself is initialized to be an array that has some number of rows and some number of columns, the result of which is that you get a nice square. And that's just convenient because you can reference location I, comma j by just indexing into that array, so to speak. And we've used one-dimensional arrays as well quite a bit. In fact, what data structure, so to speak, did we ultimately realize is implemented underneath the hood is just an array? Yeah, so a string. And we'll even push harder on that this week as to what char star truly means. But suffice it to say for now that an array is really just a chunk of contiguous memory. And if that array, for instance, happens to be called the very generic A, well, what A is in effect really is just a pointer. And it's a pointer to that chunk of memory. So take a look at this. This too is excerpted from that tutorial online. If you'd like to take a look and read over the prose that how stuff works explains pointers with. But suppose that we go ahead and when these three lines of code declare the following. An integer I, an array called A of integers, which is going to have enough room in memory for 5 integers. Well, to be clear, what's now going on in memory? And that picture really emphasizes the same thing. That first line of code allocates how much space in your computer's RAM? 4 bytes, aka 32 bits, and it calls it I. All right, what does the second line do? Well, it declares an array called A, which is actually of what size? Sorry? So 20 total bytes, right? Because 5 different ints, each of which is 4 bytes. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 gives us that. And this is effectively A. And then finally, there's this value P. And P is a pointer to an int. So it turns out it's still just 32 bits, or 4 bytes, because that's how much space any kind of pointer takes up in memory, no matter what it points to. This is called P. And now there is a bit of assignment going on there. That last line, and that last line that says star P gets A, what is that doing exactly? Sorry? The address to A, and let me clarify slightly, because we said a moment ago that an array, really, or the name of an array, is just effectively a pointer. So when you say int star p, that's just declaring a pointer called p, but it's just assigning it whatever is in A. Not A bracket 0 or A bracket 1. It's not storing a value from that array. It's not storing something that's in the array in the value p, but rather it's storing the address of this array in memory. So really, this picture is a bit misleading, because if an array's name is really just a pointer, what's really going on is that with that second line of code, you have a variable called A that's a pointer to a chunk of 5 ints somewhere in memory. And so when you then say p star p, if int star p gets A, what am I drawing an arrow here to? Yeah, so the exact same array. And to make more clear what these arrows are henceforth representing, a pointer is just an address. So this looks like some crazy value like OXBC. Well, what gets stored in here then, to be more clear? The same thing, OXBC. And that's just a number. By convention, it's typically written in hex, but the hex itself is meaningless. It doesn't mean that there's anything special going on. Yeah? Excellent question. So what if you did this in a second line? Does the syntax change? It does ever so slightly, and that's a worthy point to make. So that third line, to recreate it up here, this in one step is declaring a pointer called p to an int. But you're simultaneously assigning that the value a. That would then be equivalent, if we wanted to be ever more clear, to first saying declare me a pointer called p to an int. And then if I want to assign it the value, it would just be p gets a. So the fact that there's a star there is, in fact, potentially misleading when you do it in this slick one-liner. But what's really going on is you're declaring the pointer and then assigning to that pointer the address of the array, which has the effect of creating this picture in memory. Yeah? Okay. Ah, excellent question as well, and a very dangerous situation to have created. So suppose that we did now do this, which is not the same as this. Let's think about what this is saying. This, again, is just saying, give me a pointer called p that happens to point to an int. This line, though, is saying what? Yeah?
That you're assigning to whatever random chunk of memory p started pointing to the address of a.
And not even not the address of a, the address. Yeah, the address in A is the better way to say it. Right, so this line here declares in memory a pointer called P that's 32 bits. And as the question marks there represent, what this is really doing is who knows where this is pointing. Because again, you don't necessarily have control over what your variables, pointers, ints, chars, are initialized to. So that's just a pointer that's going off anywhere. Who knows where? But by saying star P, you're saying, who cares, follow that pointer. Go wherever the value is telling you to go and put at that location in RAM, wherever the heck it is, the value that's currently stored in A, which just happens to be an address. So odds are that this line could very well cause your program to do what? Yeah, so seg fault. And again, seg fault refers to segmentation fault, which means you're touching a segment of memory that you probably should not be touching. So this, too, is a very dangerous mistake to make, but that avoids the problem as well. All right, so with this said, let's take a look at the following, or let's go ahead and do the following. So I'm going to write a little program here called compare. For your reference, it'll be called compare one in your notes, but don't glance down just yet. I'm going to go ahead and do include standard IO again. I'm going to go ahead and declare main with int argc, char star, argv. And what the goal of this program is to do is quite simply to compare two strings that the user has typed in for equality. So let's now tie this discussion into array strings as arrays, which is what we've been promising we'd get to. So the first thing I want this program to do is just tell me what to do. So give me a string. Okay, we're going to expect the user to now give me a string. So to declare this, you know, using the CS50 library, I could say string S1 gets what? Keep everyone awake. Get string. Excellent. All right, so now we'll do this. We won't do any error checking just yet. We're just going to do this quick and dirty. All right, the next thing I want to do is have the user type the same, give me another string. So give me another string, and I'll call this S2. So I just copied and pasted that code. But now I'm going to make things slightly more clear. Remember that we promised that string is really just something in CS50's library that, at least in the first weeks, we try to use to cover up some potentially scary details. That is simply a synonym, aka a type def, for literally char star. And as we've already seen in the past couple of days, anytime we see the star, it denotes a pointer. So what I'm actually going to do to be ever more precise this time is I'm going to move away from using the CS50's synonym, string, and really be more technical and say that what this is, in fact, S1 and S2, is a char star. And we'll see where we're going with this. All right, the last thing I want to do now is just say, all right, if the first string equals the second string, well, let's go ahead and tell the user accordingly. Same. Otherwise, let's go ahead and print different if they're not the same. OK, so that's all this program does, is compare two strings. But now let's think about what this first line is doing. So when you call getString, if you call getString, what does getString return, as far as you know so far? OK, so it does return a pointer to some characters, but I'll take the simpler approach first. And presumably, it's been returning a string, right? So it is returning a string, as the name suggests. But a string, we said, is just an array of characters. So what does that mean? Well, if I type in the word foo, what this function, getString, is doing is it is, in fact, declaring enough memory in RAM for the string foo. So F-O-O. Is that it? Okay? And that special null character so that we actually know where this thing ends. What is getString returning? Well, conceptually, it's returning that thing. But this is just a chunk of memory. And what we said a moment ago is that an array is just what? It's a chunk of memory that you describe by way of its first address. That is this address. So this is 0x, again, maybe BC or something like that in hexadecimal form. So when getString returns, it's returning this value. So when you actually say S1 char star S1 gets getString, what you're really doing is declaring a variable called S1, which is a pointer to a char. And what's going inside this box because of this line? Yeah, so the value 0xbc. So to store a string in memory does mean step one for someone to declare enough space for the characters FOO and then the special null character. But to actually access the string and play around with it and remember it in a variable simply means to remember the address of its very first byte. And this is why this is sufficient. Because why do you, the programmer, only need to know the address of the first byte of a string, which again is just an array of characters? Why is that sufficient to hang on to the entire string? Yeah? So point one, the string itself, all of its characters are contiguous, one after the other after the other. They're not randomly arranged in memory where there's space. They're literally back to back to back. And what else is important? Right. So point two, there's this end marker that tells you where the end point is, which means it is literally sufficient to know where the thing begins, because just like you guys did on quiz zero, or were supposed to do on quiz zero when implementing string length, strlang, to figure out the length, you start from the starting point and then just iterate down until you see this special symbol. And if it's not there, you do indeed run into problems, but that's the risk you take when representing strings in this manner. Okay, so pictorially, this is what S1 is in memory. It's four bytes. It's just it's a pointer. But visually, what it means is that you're storing the address of this first string in memory. So now take a look at this code. Is it going to work? If the user, for instance, types in foo for both S1 and S2. Okay, no, why? Perfect answer. So even though the strings themselves might be the same, FOO\0, when you call getString two different times, the user might type that in, but each instance of FOO\0 is going to end up somewhere in memory, but certainly not the same place, because you are in fact calling getString twice. If you're then comparing S1 and S2, well, that's fine. That's valid syntax. You are perfectly welcome to compare pointers values, but all you're doing is comparing pointers values. Because what this code has the effect of doing, to be clear, is it declares S1, it declares S2, it expects a string from the user. If we suppose the user types in foo both times does the CS50 library allocate enough memory for that string to fit? It then stores the address of that in S1 and S2. When you then say, is S1 equal S2, you are comparing these two values. And because the string is presumably at two different physical places in your computer's memory, clearly S1 and S2 will not be the same. So no matter how hard you try to type the same two characters here, let's see what happens. So make compare. And again, your version of this is called compare one, which let's go ahead and add CS50's library to make the errors go away. And if I run compare, give me a string foo, give me another string foo. They are, in fact, different. And no matter how hard I try, they will always be different. So what's the solution here? How do we go about comparing strings correctly? Yeah? Do you just put stars? OK, so that's a good point. So let's try this. We know that if we want to actually access what's at a pointer's address, we can just say star. All right. So what this is saying is go to the address pointed at by S1, and go to the address pointed at by S2, which physically, if I'm now following my fingers, what is this going to compare for me? The first two characters. So partial solution. Let's go ahead and run this. So make compare, Let's go ahead and run compare. I'm going to type in foo, and I'm going to type in frank. So there's still a bug. We're one step closer, because if I do type foo foo, we do realize that they're the same. So what's the problem? Why does foo equal frank? Right, so clearly it's just because they share the same character. So the solution here is that even though this is the right idea and it's a step in the right direction, we're indeed now comparing not addresses, but actual values. But, you know, just using some of the concepts we looked at in Scratch, what do we clearly need to use here? You know, some kind of loop, and we need to actually compare each of the characters. Well, let's do this real quick. So if we want to compare each of these characters, how do we do this? Well, we can essentially say, for int I gets 0, I is less than, well, we'll use string length, because not your version, but the one that comes with C. Which one do I want to use here? Okay, so we can use S1 and then I++. And incidentally, you'll notice that in lectures code, as suggested in problem set 3's first page, I've started using what's called C99 syntax, which essentially is still C, but it has some additional neat features, like you don't need to declare all your variables at the top of a function, which has always been an annoying constraint. So I myself have begun migrating to this just so that we can focus on getting the work done rather than necessarily having to constantly go back and pre-declare everything. You're welcome to take either approach. This kind of commenting scheme that I've started using too is also a feature of C99. And frankly, it's just more convenient than constantly typing that around your comments. But either is fine, so long as you're consistent with regard to style. All right, so I'm on the path toward comparing these two strings. So really now, what do I want to do to compare two strings? Well, I can say if S1i equals S2i, what do I want to do? What's the best way to compare? We need to make sure that all of the characters are the same. So what do I want to do here? What's easier? All right, so not equals is maybe better, because it suffices to declare these things different just to find one failure to compare. So if S1 of I does not equal S2 of I, then let's go ahead and say printf different. Okay, and just to be ever more clear, we'll do this. And now I'll go ahead and return immediately. Otherwise, if I get through this whole loop and I never find something that's different, what do I want to do? Yeah, so printf, they're the same. OK, this isn't quite perfect, but let's see if it's better. So let's go ahead and make compare. Actually, we're using string length, so I have to add the string library, which, despite its name, doesn't define the data type string, but rather just some string-related function. So make compare. All right, it did compile. Let's compare this. So now let's go ahead and give it foo and foo. All right, so not bad. Foo and foo. All right, what about foo and, let's do frank and foo. Okay, so that's good. It checks out. What about foo and frank? Okay, so that's good. And just to get a little crazy here. Foo and fra? Okay. Foo and food. So there's still a problem here. So we're clearly not comparing everything. And why? Where's the bug, first of all? So less than, it's not so much a less than or equal to bug, right? Because
no, but if you do it like instead of one less than it would find the null terminator.
Okay, but that's not the source of the problem. What's the source of this problem? So if they have the same substring, but the problem is I'm just assuming that which string is longer or shorter here, right? So we actually need to exercise some judgment here. And actually, one way I can fix this is, what do you know? If the string length of S1 does not equal the string length of S2, I mean, one way we could solve this, even though we're going to be printing out the word different in two different places potentially, is to do this, right? And then return. If that's the case, otherwise we proceed to compare them, right? Because clearly the strings can't be equal if they're can't be the same if they're of different lengths. So does that solve the problem? Yes? No? And there's other ways we could do this, certainly, but that might be one approach. And even here, there is a bit of a danger, as you may realize, because it turns out, and we'll look at this either today or Friday, that getString in CS50's library doesn't necessarily return a pointer to an array in memory. For those of you who might have looked at CS50.h itself, available online, what else can getString return? So it can return this special value null. So long story short, if the user tries to provide a string that's just way too big and it just physically won't fit in memory such that the program runs out of memory, it doesn't just return part of the string, but rather it will return null, essentially the value 0, thereby signifying something went wrong. And because that I'm not checking anywhere as to whether or not S1 or S2 are null, this code could potentially crash because Stirling, the one that comes with C, doesn't check if S1 or S2 is null, and so just know for now that this code could still crash. But at least for us, it has solved this problem of comparing strings properly, actually as characters, as arrays of characters. All right, so let's see where else we can go with this. So in Fibonacci last week, we had this first really elegant but really bad performing implementation of Fibonacci. Why? What was the fundamental problem with what we called FS1, our first version of that program? It was horribly slow for like the 30th and 40th Fibonacci numbers, which aren't even that big. Why was it so darn bad? Yeah, so it ran in exponential time, which just meant essentially that we had that huge, you know, if you visualized it, that huge tree of function calls that essentially doubled in size every time you called fib for just one number larger, from 30 to 31, essentially doubled the number of times that those functions were called. Well, we, long story short, sort of fixed this problem by introducing what into like our third version of that thing? Yeah, so this idea of memoization. We used a memo, which in English is good for what? What do you do with a memo? Sorry? Yeah, so you remember inputs and outputs so that you don't have to recompute those same things again. The problem, though, with something like FS for computing the Fibonacci sequence is my program doesn't necessarily know in advance what Fibonacci number I'm going to ask for, which is to say, how big must my memo be for that program? Well, if I input a number n, how big must my memo be for Fibonacci if I'm going to keep all those previous values around? N and almost. Yeah, so maybe n plus 1, just in case we actually want to store the last value, but even that's debatable. So we at least need a memo, an array that is, of size n. But n is dynamic, right? It's not a value you, the programmer, necessarily know at the time you sit down at your terminal and write the Fibonacci sequence code. So what could you do? So how could you write that program in such a way that you do have a memo that's an array, but it's plenty big for whatever the user types in, even though you don't know in advance what that guy's going to type in? What could you do? What's the simplest solution to that problem? Yeah?
Can you just declare an array of number elements n and have it built into the program?
Ah, so... Yes, thanks to C99, yes, you can, which is, okay, good answer. You can. There is, let me summarize as follows. It's not a great thing to declare your array sizes dynamically in that way because the memory ends up on the stack, which means you can't necessarily safely pass the memory around always, or it doesn't behave necessarily in the way we might want it to. But let's say, yes, that's true, but let me go in a different direction, just because we'll see a more versatile solution. But that is fair. What's that? OK, so you might not bother declaring a size, but I guess where I'm going with this perhaps leading question is, well, why don't you just declare a really big memo that's big enough for any n the user might type in, right? Realistically, the user's not going to be asking you for the 16 billionth Fibonacci number because we just can't express that high of a number in C right now. We would need to do much crazier things because we don't have the data type to express particularly large values. At least there's certainly a bound in real terms. But why don't we just declare a really big array? Like, what's the biggest array we might be able to declare using the syntax we know? So, like, what's the biggest int that you can pass to an array? Because that's what an array expects when you declare its size. So why don't we just declare what's the biggest possible int? Right, so 2 to the third, and if we used unsigned int even, 2 to the 32 minus 1. So why don't we just declare our memo of size 2 to the 32? Good? Bad? Well, what 2 to the 32 is roughly what? This is where these numbers come in handy. It's like 4 billion. So we're already talking 4 billion entries in your memo, and how big was each of those? Well, it was actually a long, which is 8 bytes. So we're already talking, I mean, tens of gigabytes to implement the Fibonacci sequence just so you can keep your answers around, right? That's just excessive, and it's not feasible. So better is perhaps an approach where you don't just pre-allocate all possible memory that you might ever want to use, but you do so dynamically. And you can indeed do so just by declaring an array, though just again, suffice it to say you run into problems. You can do it with a new function called malloc. So this is a memory allocation function, and in this in FS3, which you saw last week, we actually had this, but I waved my hands at it and we didn't draw attention to it. But this line of code here, these lines of code have the effect in the first line of storing in what we knew that day as memo, the return value of a function called malloc, which is passed a mathematical expression there, and then it's apparently cast into a long. Or what does any of that mean? So malloc, henceforth, is just a function that returns to you a chunk of memory. That is to say, if you pass call malloc of 4, what that does for you is it asks the operating system, hey, this developer wants 4 bytes of memory. Please find it in RAM. Go ahead and allocate it as a contiguous block of memory and then return, guess what? Yeah, return the address of the first such byte, and let the developer assume that the rest of the memory is contiguous, back to back to back, exactly like getString, exactly like an array. In fact, the means by which we implement getString so we can accept a string of any length from the user is to use malloc. So we just figure out how many characters has the user typed, let's allocate enough space, and then return to you, the programmer, the address of the first byte. So that first line of code, take a look at the argument to malloc. So again, the context here was the Fibonacci program. Why am I passing to malloc in order to instantiate my memo? N plus 1 times size of long. What is that saying to malloc? Again, new function, but simple idea. Yeah. Yeah, that's all. Like, give me enough memory for n plus 1 longs and n plus 1 so that we can start counting at 0. But we can actually compute the nth Fibonacci number. Why then am I casting it to a long star? This is just a piece of syntax that you should bear in mind. Malloc doesn't know what you're going to use this memory for, right? It doesn't care or know whether you're going to put ints there, chars there, a memo there. It doesn't care. So by using this explicit cast, you can specify to GCC, treat this chunk of memory as effectively an array of longs. Now wait a minute, I said array, but there's no bracket notation there. But again, as we said a few moments ago, essentially an array is synonymous with a pointer, and so saying long star is like saying an array of longs. That's all that's going on here. So the second line of code, if memo equals null, why is that there? It's clearly checking for null, but who cares? So if it's too big, right? So let's actually, this is FS4. Let's go ahead and make FS4. I'm going to go ahead and compute FS4 of the 30th Fibonacci number. All right, and that worked pretty well. And there's a lot of debugging information there that just tells me if it found the value in the memo or if it computed it for the first time. Let's try 50. The program's quite fast. That was the point of those three versions of FS. But what if I get a little crazy here and start typing in, let's say, 1 million? Okay, so it's actually going to take, in retrospect, stupid to print all the debugging information, perhaps. Let's turn that off. So let's find our printf statements where it's doing that. We're just going to comment them out. And is it printed anywhere else? Yep, we're going to get rid of that. And we're going to get rid of that. Actually, I think we want to keep this last one, otherwise we'll all be for naught. Okay. Okay, now let's run FS of 1 million. Ooh. All right, so what happened here? So it clearly can't handle that value. Why might that actually be? What might be going on? I mean, we'll summarize it with with this. Most any time you run into these segmentation faults, it's because you've tried to allocate too much memory and you didn't get it back, but you just assume naively that you did get it back and you start using memory that you don't own, or you access what's called a null pointer. And malloc, no for now, returns null if you simply don't have enough memory in RAM. If there's not enough memory in RAM available that you've asked for, malloc will not just return part of it, it will return none of it if you ask for too much memory. So we'll see more examples of malloc in the future, but just to put this into context now, all that's been going on here now is use of this picture. So remember that the stack is where what gets stored in terms of memory? Sorry? So functions, and not functions per se, but what about functions get stored on the so-called stack? So they're variables. Parameters to functions end up on the stack. Their local variables end up on the stack. But the neat thing about this new function, and we'll start using this not for the current problem set, and maybe not even for problem set 4, but in the weeks to come, especially when we start implementing the fastest dictionary for a future problem set. And when you implement your own compression algorithm, you'll also use malloc as well. What's nice about malloc is that unlike local variables, which only exist for the life of a function because that memory is put onto the stack, with malloc, the memory comes from a very different place in your computer's memory, the analog to the stack, which grows top on down conceptually, which is the so-called heap. So for today, know that anytime you use malloc to allocate memory, it's persistent. It stays in your program really as a global variable in a sense. Even if you call malloc in a function called foo and foo returns, that memory continues to live on and it's still yours to own. So the nice thing about allocating memory with malloc and letting it end up on the heap is that it persists across your function calls until you yourself explicitly free up that memory by calling a function called free, which we'll see in additional examples. But now let's finally, now that we have this jargon for talking about pointers and this notion of arrays and malloc and such, let's go ahead and pull up the following example called scanf scanf.c. So in scanf.c, there's only 4 lines of code here. And let's see what's going on. And this will make clear exactly what's been going on for some 3 weeks in CS50's library. Just looking at the code here, trying to ignore the comments, what does this program do? Okay, so I'll do the first easy ones. Right, declares a variable called x. Says prints number please. Now there's a new function, scanf. Some of you have used this, especially for the hacker problem sets. But scanf, guess what it's doing? Sorry? It assigns a value to a variable from the user. So most of you have never used scanf because you've instead, if you wanted to get an int from the user, what have you used? Getint. Well, know now that we've been implementing getInt with essentially this function underneath the hood. It's a little cryptic to show on the first day of a class for someone who's never programmed, but what this is doing, and we now have the means of explaining this with pointers, is the following. We want the value that the user types to end up in a variable called x. Well, in order to do that, we can call scanf. We tell scanf what kind of data the user's about to type in using exactly the same formatting codes that you've used with printf, but then we tell scanf where to put that value. But here, notice already is that same topic of passing by value and passing by reference. If I passed a function called scanf, the variable x, could scanf physically put in x anything reliably? That is, when scanf returns, would x's value have changed? So no. So even though we've introduced all this pointer magic lately, if you're passing a variable literally by value, it is literally the function that's receiving it getting what? A copy. It's getting a copy of those 32 bits. And that can do whatever it wants with them, but it can't access x. But if you do want one of your functions to actually be able to control the contents of a variable, what if you do this? What is this effectively doing for scanf? Well, you're passing it the address now of x. Why is that useful? Yeah, in back.
Strings
Yeah, exactly. So if you essentially give scanf a roadmap to where that variable is in memory, just let scanf follow the arrow, so to speak, and drop the value in there. So what happens now when we run this thing, if we run make scanf, and we go ahead and run scanf and go ahead and type in a number, well, thanks for the 5. It ended up going in that value, a variable. If we put 10, it ends up in there as well. Well, can we do one better than this? In scanf2, now notice what I'm doing. Now I'm going to implement or show you what's going on with the getString function you've been using. But this isn't quite right. This version is, in fact, buggy, scanf2. So notice that this first line of code is declaring what? Translate that into English. So it's declaring a string, but now we got to start being more precise. It's not declaring a string per se, because what is a string really, right? That's just been a nice sort of layman's term we've been using. It's declaring a pointer to a char. Now, what can that be? Well, it can be a pointer to an array of characters, and that would be what we know as a string. But for now, it's just declaring the pointer to a char. If I now called scanf with this third line of code, I use %s because it's a string conceptually that I want to store in there, but I pass it buffer. Well, buffer's the right idea, right? I want to pass scanf an address so that it knows where to put the characters I type in. But what is problematic about this implementation? So there's no null check, but even worse than that. So there's only one space. There's not even just one space, because what do we know about variables if we haven't initialized them? Well, so there's space for the variable, for the pointer, but who knows where it's pointing? So buffer is not only pointing who knows where, it's certainly not pointing to an array of bytes that we own. So where is scanf going to put the characters I type? Well, so it's going to put it at the address pointed to by buffer, but we don't even know where that is. It's certainly not memory we own. If I go ahead then and run scanf2 and type in a string like foo, I mean, very quickly does it dump core, so to speak, because we've just tried to touch memory we don't own. What if I instead just type something shorter? Let's just type f. Even then, I didn't get away with it because it's just not my memory. So how do we fix this? What clearly needs to happen if we want scanf to be able to read some number of characters into a buffer? Well, fix this for me. What do I do? So we could absolutely use malloc. So we could, and that's actually a great way of tying these discussions together. If I wanted to be safe here, I could indeed say char star, this is the casting bit that we used earlier. I could malloc, and you know, I know a char is how many bytes? One char. All right, I know it's just one byte per char. So I could just get a little lazy here and say, give me 128 chars, right? This would return 128 bytes, assuming there's enough in RAM, which hopefully there are in today's systems. We're going to specify that this is going to be treated as a char star, aka string, and store the address of that chunk of memory in buffer. So now, when scanf reads a string into buffer, how much room does it indeed have? So it does indeed have, at least it has 128 bytes. So let's go ahead and recompile this, run scanf, now type in foo. OK, so now we seem to have fixed this, but there is still a problem, right? And I don't really want to type a really long sentence here. So let's say that I only typed in 4 bytes, right? The user's going to type foo, bar, baz, right? David never uses any other examples, so let's just go with 4. So let's run scanf of 2, scanf2, string please, foo. We're safe. Do I have leftover memory? No, why? So that null character did, in fact, get stored in the 4th location. But now, OK, foo, bar, baz, all at once, still worked. All right, well, let's just try a longer string, foo, bar, baz, with no spaces. Even that worked, even though that's not my memory. Foo, well, let's just do this. Right, at some point, still working. Why is this working? Yeah, and back. Isn't buffer only storing? So no. So buffer itself is a pointer. It's storing the address in memory of that chunk of 4 bytes. What's that? the address of the first byte. But what scanf does is it assumes that that address demarks a contiguous chunk of memory that it can just start putting characters in one by one. But the dangerous thing about scanf, it's still working. So, well, so this is the thing, and this is why some of you might swear to the teaching fellows in the lab that your program was working 10 minutes ago, and yet the TF comes to grade it or comes to help you out, and it's then not working. When it comes to memory management, you can't necessarily trust that the behavior is going to be the same on every invocation of your program if you're doing dangerous things with your memory. And I hope this crashes, because otherwise, this really isn't making as strong of a point. But damn it! Anyhow, it turns out that malloc is indeed returning us 4 bytes. And we're clearly reading into beyond that 4-byte boundary, as my J's and F's suggested. But we got lucky. I mean, where were all those J's and F's going? So it's not going to crash as often on the heap, correct? So, and the, right, so the implications are, yes, malloc does give us space on the heap, right? So the heap, again, is that chunk of memory where, as the picture itself suggested, there's a heck of a lot of room there. So we are, in fact, overwriting memory that we don't own, but fortunately, we weren't overwriting memory that anyone else was using or that was a different segment. And before we pack up, let me take this one other approach. Rather than using malloc, it turns out that I could have just done this on the stack, right? If a string is technically just an array, if I instead did this, that has the same effect in terms of how much memory gets allocated to buffer. It's an array of 4 bytes. Okay, but where does that memory get allocated? Because I'm allocating it now not with malloc, but just as an old school variable declaration. So this time it's now on the stack. If I recompile this program now, run scanf 2, and now, here we go, cross your fingers. Now I've clearly overrun the array that I've allocated, but now we're in the stack, which means we're very close to main and some other scary thing, or things that are in fact in use. I guess I'm done. See you Friday. The TFs have it quizzes for you. Thomas?
Yeah, we should